All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today is going to be, it's going to be packed and it's going to be interesting. And we're going to press ahead real quick. So I'm going to be real quick in the introduction. So we have as much time to spend talking with everybody. At the back end of the show, we'll be joined once again by Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution and initiator of StopPatriarchy.org, who's in the middle of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. And we'll be talking to her from Wichita, Kansas, which is where they are now. In the middle section of the show, we're going to be talking with Dave Lindorf. Dave's been a guest on the show a number of times. He's an investigative journalist and author. And we're going to be talking about the encroaching police state in the U.S., all right? And that should be very interesting. Dave is, once again, really PO'd and has a lot to say about this. Opening the show up, I really think this is one of the most important issues out there today, and it's something that I've been trying to pay a lot of attention to. This is something that people really have to keep their eyes and ears open and really stand with the prisoners, all right? This is about the California prisoner hunger strike. And most recently, there's been a number of developments in the hunger strike, and most recently some things that have been really troubling and people need to actually respond to, understand where they're coming from and the importance of them, the significance of it, and respond to it. As the California prison hunger strike enters its second month, okay, with hundreds of prisoners continuing to refuse food in protest of the harsh conditions of indefinite solitary confinement, there have been reports of all kinds of harassment that's being brought down on the strikers inside the prisons by the prison authorities. A number of prisoners have begun to face health problems, and one prisoner, Billy Sell in Corcoran, in the Corcoran Shoe, has died. While his fellow prisoners report that Sell had asked for medical assistance that was never delivered, the California Department of Corrections claims that Sell committed suicide. In the face of the strike, the response of the California Department of Corrections, one of the world's biggest jailers, has been to attack and retaliate against prisoners and their leaders. Now, Jeffrey Beard, the head of the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, has published a piece in the LA Times arguing that this hunger strike is not about protesting living conditions that constitute torture, but is instead prison gangs attempting to restore their ability to terrorize fellow prisoners, prison staff, and communities throughout California. Joining us to talk about all this is Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're going to talk with Carl about this horrific statement and take a step back to look at what is actually revealed in the prisoner hunger strike. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into it, man. You read the Jeff Beard piece. You read that. What's your overall take on that?
Well, two things. The first thing is that it is deceitful, lying, and other similar adjectives, which I probably shouldn't use on the radio. The man is trying to take advantage of the fact that most people don't know what the situation is inside the prisons, particularly in the shoes, to lie about what they really are, to undercut any pull that people might have to have sympathy for and support for the prisoners. The other thing is that the very fact that the CDCR and the California authorities felt the need to write such a lying piece indicates that they're being stung by the heroic stand that the prisoners are taking and the fact that there is broad support that still needs to grow, still needs to become broader, more determined, but there is enough support that they felt they had to come out and try to tamp things down and undercut that growing support.
You know, Carl, there is that element. I'm really glad you brought that up because there is very much, it seems to me, an element of stuck pigs do squeal. You know, it's like, can't help but say that one, all right? And I think it's something that we all should consider because, look, there is a point here. I know when I've written to people and sent out things about the hunger strike, in the initial period, there was interest. There was people saying, oh, is this, you know, what's the connection between this and the other one? But then as it went on, this has actually had a real inspirational impact among a very significant section of people. I mean, there's a lot of people, including many prominent people, who have stood up and said, we are not going to stand by and watch as this section of the population, as this section of humanity is consistently and thoroughly dehumanized and left to rot behind these massive walls, and we're not going to do anything about it, that this impacts all of us. It reminded me a lot of the Attica Rebellion back in 1971 in Attica State Prison in New York, where the prisoners stood up and said, hey, we are human beings, and we demand to be treated as such. And a lot of people got behind the prisoners, had their back, joined with them. It seems like there's a little bit of that going on, and the same kind of lies were spewed out then and now.
Yes, I think that's very important because there was the International Day of Support. People in this country, but also some places in Europe went on one-day hunger strikes. A number of celebrities stood in support of it. There's been the activity of the family members of some of the people in the shoes. They have been very active trying to get the word out and bringing out the truth of what the situation faced by these people in prison is, and underscoring the heroic nature of what people are doing. You know, because I've been on conference calls with some of these family members, and they talked about how their loved ones were only just getting back their weight from the previous hunger strikes in 2011. So it was really a case of putting your life on the line, you know, to fight for this kind of change in the conditions, the kind of thing that Jeff Beard lyingly claims that this isn't about. So that was very important, and you do get the sense that they felt like we have to come out real hard, real strong to push things back to where they were, to where people weren't supporting these people in prison. And a big theme of theirs is this thing of these people are irredeemable criminals who have to be treated virtually inhumanely. We have to bring all this down on them to keep them under control. And see, that's part of the deceit in this, because from one end, the people in prison aren't claiming that they never did anything wrong. What this really points to is that people who have done some horrifying things, some degrading things, can in fact transform themselves, particularly through the course of standing up and fighting against injustice, which is exactly what's going on. Because one of the things that Beard does not mention is that the prisoners have issued a cessation of racial hostilities, basically an agreement to end a situation of fighting among prisoners of different races, which they have come to understand is part of how the prison authorities keep the prison under control. They brutalize all the prisoners, but then they play on the divisions among the prisoners and even exacerbate them, like things like a few years ago it was exposed that in the Corcoran prison facility, the guards would take prisoners of different races and nationalities, put them one from each group in the yard together, egg them on to fight, and then bet on the outcome, basically holding gladiator fights. So this question of prisoners fighting amongst each other is something that the authorities were not only aware of, but used to their own advantage. Well, the prisoners are rising above that. And this points again to the capability and the potential for people to transform themselves in the fight against injustice, which is an important thing being revealed through this hunger strike.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about recent developments in the California prisoner hunger strike, and in particular, this really vicious op-ed piece that ran in the LA Times on August 6th. And it was a piece by Jeff Beard, who's the head of the California Departments of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and it was just a vicious, vicious attack piece. Now, Carl, one of the things, without parsing out the whole op-ed and all this other stuff, there are some things here, I think, that it's not just that it flies in the face of actually what's going on and that there's stuck pigs squealing and all this other stuff, but there's a whole point here of that the problem is, he asserts that, like, well, the conditions aren't really as bad as what people say, but it's also, this is all aimed at sort of driving a wedge between the prisoners and the public that has come out to support, or people who are beginning to open their eyes up and say, I didn't know this kind of stuff happened in this place. You know, who could remember that? You know, and that's a situation where it's really, it seems to me, it's also, so this attack is not only full, chock full of lies, but they're lies that actually have a very dangerous purpose.
Yes, extremely. I just want to say one thing about the conditions. See, because I've been on conference calls with family members of these prisoners, and, you know, he talks about, well, the shoe cells have skylights, and all of the, at Pelican Bay, they have skylights. At the other ones, everybody has windows opening on the sun. Well, one woman talked about going to visit her loved one and not recognizing him initially because he was several shades lighter because he hadn't gotten direct sunlight for several years, the several years he had spent in the shoes. Another woman talked about going to visit her son, and when she began to talk with him through the phones that you have to use because of the barriers, he cried out in agony and put the phone down and then explained to her that hearing her voice hurt his ears because it was the first time in more than a year that he had heard a human voice. These are the conditions that are being enforced, and they are torture. But then they lie about this, blame the prisoners for the situation, and try to justify the inhumane treatment that they're bringing down on people, that, you know, they had no choice but to enforce these conditions because it was the only way to keep the prisoners under control. And when what is actually happening is that this torture is part of a larger program of suppression and control directed at sections of people that this capitalist system can no longer profitably exploit. And they looked back at the 1960s, saw the upheaval that came from the risings of black people against the horrific conditions that they faced, and determined that before any future such risings happened, they needed to hit hard with a program that is mass incarceration. And this torture is a concentration point of that. Dehumanizing and brutalizing sections of the people they incarcerate as part of controlling the whole thing. And they very much need to isolate the people in prison from those outside, because the U.S. is already being looked at around the world as a world-class torturer because of what goes on in Guantanamo Bay, what happened in Abu Ghraib. They don't want it out that tens of thousands of people in the continental U.S. itself are being subjected to the same kind of torture. And that's what this represents. It's just torture, straight up, plain and simple. And it needs to be exposed, both in terms of combating it, but also for people to get more of a sense of the nature of this system and what can and must be done about it.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about recent developments in the California prisoner hunger strike, and in particular, this really vicious op-ed piece that ran in the LA Times on August 6th. And it was a piece by Jeff Beard, who's the head of the California Departments of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Now, Carl, we have about a little bit under 7 minutes left, and so I have two more questions I wanted to get to. And I actually have about 20, but we don't have the time. So, you know, one of the things that you're just talking about this whole claim, and see, this is really important because people need to look at Beard's op-ed piece. And they need to also look, I would recommend that people go to revcom.us and read the statement that's been issued by the Revolutionary Communist Party in response to Beard's op-ed piece. Because there it talks about how dangerous all these, and it does parse it out, how many lies are concentrated in a couple of paragraphs. It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't think even the words like "the" are true in that thing. You know, it's like it's just soaked in lies and vicious horror. And one of the things that I think, though, that really comes up, that really struck me, is, you know, we have a situation, as you're well aware, we have 2.4 million people in jail, more than half of them black and Latino. This whole massive explosion of incarceration, and especially of people from oppressed nationalities. And Beard has the audacity to claim that mass incarceration is something that the people brought, that elements from the people brought on themselves. The gang violence in the 70s and the 80s, and that what was leading up to that, and really something had to be done, and then to get in prison, and it continued, and then we had to build the shoe units and all this stuff. And it's really, you know, it's really such a filthy lie. And what it does is it actually, again, exactly what you're saying, is it points people in the direction of they brought it on themselves, and we're just protecting you from people or creatures that you have no idea who they really are and what they would do to you if let loose.
Yes, and see, this is very important because it turns reality on its head. It takes what the system itself has done to people, the stripping of the ghettos and barrios of legitimate ways to survive and raise families, the gearing of the educational systems to fail the youth there, and that stripping of the legitimate ways to survive flows from the very nature of capitalism, moving manufacturing from this country to halfway around the world where they can exploit people much more viciously, pay them much less, work them in much more dangerous conditions, and then having to develop an approach to deal with the people in the inner cities that they no longer had a use for. And that's where mass incarceration and all of the components of that came, you know, the disparate way that the criminal injustice system is unleashed to target those areas, whether that's stop and frisk in New York or the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity for crack and powder cocaine. But then to turn all that around and say, well, this came from you all. You all got into the gang violence. You all got into crime and drugs, and we had no choice but to try to deal with that, and this is what we came up with. Mm-hmm. And then to just straight up lie about it, you know, in terms of, well, people are in the shoes because they're gang members and they're, you know, trying to run criminal enterprises outside of the prison. When in reality, you could end up in the shoes. First off, it's essentially arbitrary, but even more, it is not even based on what you do. You can have a tattoo that they decide is gang-related. You could have a piece of artwork that they decide is gang-related. You could be reading a book that they decide is a gang thing, and then you're in the shoe with no way to get out except to snitch on somebody else.
You know, Carl, one of the things that's also very true and very, very important for people to realize is that there are a number of people who are in the shoe because of their politics, because of their, the, you know, radical politics and some even revolutionary politics. And this is this will be the last question, because I think I want to spend a little bit of time on this, and we have about 4 minutes, something like that. I'd like you to talk about, you mentioned already the thing about, one thing for people to really be aware of is that what's revealed in the strike is the transformation, the potential for transformation that's going on among the prisoners and that is possible among the prisoners. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, because see, this is real important, because you are talking about people who have been cast down and cast out by this system, and some of whom have done horrible things to other people. But then you see they stand up, they fight for justice, and through the course of this fight and leading into this fight, they have transform themselves. They've gotten out of the dog eat dog, look out for number one, stab everybody else in the back kind of outlook, and are looking at what future is there going to be. What about the future generations? What about humanity? Even in terms of taking up this fight, some of them have talked about in letters that they've written to Revolution newspaper that they're not sure that they'll win this for themselves, but they want to be part of stopping this for future generations and that no one else will be subjected to this kind of torture. There's also, people really should go to RevCom to look at the response to the Jeff Beard op-ed, because there's a lot in there that I won't be able to get to, but let me just point to one thing that it brings up there. It points to a quote from Bob Avakian that's in his book Basics about an appeal to those the system has cast off. And Avakian talks about how those who have been cast off by them, people who have no future within it, can be an important catalyst to the development of a movement for revolution, a movement that's aimed at ending this system, and not only the horror that it brings down on them, but the horror that it enforces on all of humanity. And I think that's important to cite in relation to this struggle, because this struggle against torture is something that has already touched people, not only in this country, but around the world. A group in London retweeted a tweet that I did on day 31 of the California prison hunger strike. So it's being looked at around the world, and it points to the potential for people who have been cast down by this society to not only stand up and fight injustice, but to become part of the emancipators of humanity, to become part of a movement that is aiming to end this criminal, illegitimate system, because that's what's revealed by the widespread torture that they enforce. And I have to speak to this. Eric Holder made a statement where he said to the authorities in Russia, give us Snowden back, we promise not to kill or torture him. But see, part of what's contained in that statement is that the torture that they inflict in the U.S. isn't torture, because it's being done by the United States, the same as waterboarding's not torture. being by the Americans, who are, by definition, good guys. So the illegitimacy of this setup is being exposed much more broadly by the heroic actions of these prisoners, and that's very important, not only for this important struggle for justice, but for the potential that it brings forward for what's needed to deal with this horror once and for all, and all the other horrors that people are being inflicted on by this system, and that's a movement for revolution.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again real soon.
Okay, thanks for having me on again, Mike.
All right, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to tell you again, go to revcom.us to find out lots of stuff about the California prisoner hunger strike and also to read some of this response that was issued to Jeff Beard's vicious op-ed piece in the LA Times. A really important response that I really recommend people check out, all right, to get some truth into our lives, all right? Some truth that on that basis we can actually change the world. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking with Dave Lindorf. Dave is an author and journalist, and we'll be talking with him about the growing police state in the U.S. What? Are you kidding me? Dave will yell it out to us, so stay tuned.
Attention, attention, attention. American forces are here to help. Remain calm. We will not tolerate civil disobedience. Attention, attention, attention. American forces are here to help. Remain calm. We will not tolerate civil disobedience.
Attention, attention, attention. Armed personnel are here to assist you. If you resist, then they're gonna get you. Once they got you, ain't no telling what they're gonna do with you. Probably ship you to get mobay. That's what you get when you disobey. It's the new order, forget the old way, cause you a terrorist now if you miss the old days. Man, they keep us in probate, warrantless checkpoints on all of the roadways. Just take a look around when you hear that sound. You know this shit ain't gonna be okay.
All right. And that's a guy named Nathan Frazier. I don't know nothing about him, but I found that piece just looking around for stuff on police state. All right. And that's really a great piece there. All right. I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Dave Lindorf. Dave has been on the show a number of times, but I'm going to remind you again, he's a founding member of This Can't Be Happening, an online newspaper collective. He's also the author of Killing Time, a major work of investigatory journalism on the framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And Dave is also a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion from AK Press. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's, I was telling somebody the other day, I said, look, you know, I got to have Dave on the show because I read his pieces and he's increasingly angry, which is really healthy and invigorating to find in the world today. And you've been writing about the danger of encroaching police state in this country for quite some time. And in the last couple of weeks, the bubble seems to have burst to a certain degree. All kinds of things are coming out where people's heads are spinning and there's people beginning to see some of the truth. And then there's also this massive effort to clean up and extend, get things back on track by the government. So let's jump into this. What the hell's going on, Dave? What do you think about it?
Well, it's pretty astonishing. I mean, I've been warning about the growing police state for some time, but even I've been, like, stunned by the Snowden revelations because people were talking about this, and I was sort of going, nah, they can't do that. I mean, it's technologically impossible, and it's not. I mean, the level of spying on average, ordinary Americans has vastly exceeded what was done by, I guess, the most extreme example in our history to date has been the Stasi in East Germany, which I had a lot of experience with because as a 15-year-old, I lived in West Germany and heard a lot about it. And then as a journalist back in 1990, I had the experience of going to Berlin before the wall came down entirely and before East Germany ceased to exist, and traveling around because it was an open, much more open place at that point, and meeting with these Germans, getting a tour of the Stasi compounds and stuff, and just seeing how vast that was. And at the time, it just was staggering. But that was all with paper. and file, vast warehouses of files that they couldn't even look through. They had so much data on all the citizens. But now these guys have this ability with these supercomputers and like acres and acres of them out in Utah and elsewhere, that they can like riff through this stuff and find your email to your mother on December 14th in a flash. Mm-hmm. They can see everything. So that's quite amazing and terrifying. And that's just the spying part of it.
Well, but, you know, one other thing.
The police state's much bigger than mm-hmm. just spying. I mean, look at there was just a piece I saw about how we're living in an occupied country already because the local police have become armies and have become vastly larger. I mean, 30,000 cops in New York, 10,000 cops in Los Angeles City, not counting the sheriffs and all the police in the various, you know, urban jurisdictions within LA County. I mean, it's just incredible how many police there are, and you watch them arm up like soldiers whenever they have an action.
You know, it's really very heavy what you're saying, because I've thought about this a lot. You know, there's also these you know, really touted, highly touted fusion centers that bring together these joint committees of all the various police forces that the state and nationally has, you know, and local police forces and all for one thing. And that is to carry out this like program of severe, you know, repression and all this kind of in the guise of anti-terrorism. This creation of a scaffolding, and actually more than a scaffolding now, putting meat on the scaffolding of a actual police state. You know, and it's interesting because when you're talking about this thing, one of the things they just recently revealed was not only, you know, remember when they were saying back a couple weeks ago in the good old days when they were saying, well, we only look at the addresses, we don't know who, you know, who did. Now they just came out yesterday and they said, well, actually, you know, we do kind of scan the content every now and then.
Yeah, and that's a fallback position. Right. Bet that they look a lot more than occasionally. Look, the you know, you mentioned the fusion centers. I can't remember whether I was on your show to talk about the documents that I exposed and wrote about in Houston, where the FBI actually knew about a plot to execute the leaders of the Occupy movement in Texas in four cities and did nothing about it. And they wrote about it to the other fusion centers and FBI offices, and we have at least two documents relating to it, one from Houston and one from the FBI Gainesville office in Florida, referencing this plot. But when I asked about it, the FBI, it turned out the FBI did nothing about it, and the Houston Police Department claims they weren't informed about it.
You know, Dave, let me do some ID real quick. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave is a founding member of the This Can't Be Happening newspaper collective, an online newspaper collective, and we're talking with Dave about the encroaching police state in the U.S., You know, now, Dave, this actually reminds me a lot of that old Nixon line, you know, where, you know, Nixon had taped all these conversations that he had with various members of his administration in the Oval Office, and they talked a lot about the crimes that the administration was committing. And when he got caught in the Watergate scandal and all this began to come out, there was an 18-minute gap in one of the tapes, and there was a lot of speculation about what was going on there. And at one point, somebody said, well, it's very likely that Nixon was talking with members of his administration about various crimes that they had committed. And one of his top guys, I don't know whether it was Haldeman or Ehrlichman, and they said, well, yes, they could have been talking about that. But then he was also saying, well, we could do that, but it would be wrong. This is the circus, and unfortunately, it's a not really, you know, it's not a good circus. It's really this horror show that's going on. When you think about what you just brought up, you have those kinds of crimes that are being committed on a massive scale by this system here and all across the world. And then you have people like Bradley Manning, Ed Snowden, Julian Assange, all of these people who are out there saying, you know, who are standing up around this. And we've been treated to, these are the people that are public enemy number one. And,
yeah, right.
You know, insane. Go ahead.
Appropriately, Manning's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by somebody in Norway who said it would be a way to redeem the Nobel Committee.
Yeah.
You know, from their Obama nomination.
Yeah.
I mean, really, these guys are heroes. They're incredible heroes. And I think it's hopeful that the polls show that a majority of Americans do believe that Snowden did the right thing. They're a little confused because people are such, you know, are so propagandized here that what they'll say is, well, he should face the legal system, you know, because he did steal the documents, but he did the right thing. They want him to be like, you know, Martin Luther King, you know, marching and knowing he's going to prison. But it's not the same thing anymore. That's what people need to get into their heads. The courts are not fair anymore, if they ever, to the extent that they were in the past, and I think they were sometimes surprisingly fair, they aren't anymore because the system has been rigged. First of all, they've appointed judges who are like total shills for the government over and over again over these years, and the Obama administration's been as bad at it as the Bush administration in that respect. But also, what's happening now is that partly because of the judges that are picked, when you go to trial as a Edward Snowden or a Jose Padilla or something, your ability to argue the case on, say, constitutional grounds, First Amendment grounds or whistleblower grounds, are erased because the government's position is that's not germane to what you did, and the judges say, yeah, I won't allow any testimony on First Amendment issues. They even did this to in L.A. to a guy who wrote a protest on the sidewalk, and he was arrested for defacing public property and by the LAPD, and the judge ruled out a First Amendment defense, saying that there was no issue there. He had defaced public property, and that was the issue, not free speech. And mm-hmm. this was with chalk, not with paint.
Right. Yeah. And he was threatened with prison. I mean, this is the
yeah,
this is,
yeah. So that's the kind of country we're living in now. And I think the you know, the police state thing is like, I went out and tested hitchhiking. I do it every once in a while to just sort of, you know, capture the zeitgeist. And so I'm out in my own town, standing on the side of the road on the grass with my thumb out, and this cop, looked like he was straight out of the Marine Corps, comes by in his black SUV, shaking his head grimly, comes out, tells me, you can't do that. And I said, why not? And he says, it's illegal. And I said, where's it illegal? In town, in the state? He said, everywhere. And I said, I don't think you're right about that. And he said, if you argue with me anymore, I'm taking you in and locking you up. And it turns out he was wrong. You know, I called the chief of police in my own town, which was like right across the street, the border, you know, and he laughed. He said he was a hitchhiker in his college days, and he said, you're totally within your rights standing on the grass, but would that have done me any good if I said that? Now I printed out the law. I got it in my shirt pocket when I hitchhike.
And but, Dave, you're very lucky that you're not black, because after you said, no, you're wrong, the next word from the cop would have been, bam!
No, that's right. Exactly. I was wearing regular street clothes, and I was a white guy, although I do have a beard, but that doesn't quite do it. But especially these days. But you're right. If I'd been a black guy, I would not have been able to make that first.
Yeah, black or Latino, you would have been dead. Dave, let me real quick let people know who we're talking to. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Dave Lindorf, who's part of the This Can't Be Happening Collective, an online newspaper collective, and we're talking about the growing police state in the U.S. Now, Dave, one of the things I'd like to get into, because we're running up on our time, we have about maybe 7 minutes left, I want to talk to you about what was concentrated in the Manning verdict and the trial and the verdict, but there was something, not so much the particulars, but there was something very heavy that was concentrated in that. And you've spoken to that in some of your pieces about the press was going, oh, well, you know, he wasn't convicted of aiding the enemy, but then there were 19 other charges that he was convicted of, many of which have an extremely dark cloud for the future in this country and around the world. Let's talk about that, the implications of that for not just these three people or four people, whatever, but including Julian Assange, who I don't want to forget, because that brother is going to be, I mean, they are, he came up, what, 150 times or something during the Manning trial.
The Manning trial was all about getting Assange. Mm-hmm. I mean, really what they didn't count on Manning being such a stand-up hero to not cut a deal and rat out Assange, because what they were trying to do was get Manning to say he was put up to this, and you know, they were really hoping he'd say he was paid to release this information to WikiLeaks, because if that had happened, they would have been able to nail Assange as an abettor of an act of espionage. But Manning was quite forthright in saying, I did this, I approached them, this was my doing, and he's taking the rap for it, and he's not trying to cut a deal, which he could have done. He could have lied. He could have said, you know, he paid me to do this, and they could have given him a slap on the wrist, and he could have walked away. So because he's a stand-up guy, and he deserves astonishing credit for taking it after, you know, the tortures they put him through for 8 to 12 months in solitary and, you know, stripping him for weeks on end in his cold cell and stuff. You know, just amazing guy. But the charges he got convicted of, primarily the serious ones, were the Espionage Act convictions, because while they didn't, it's really weird. I mean, if he wasn't convicted of aiding an enemy, right, then how can you have espionage without an enemy, right? And yet he's convicted of espionage on multiple counts because the Espionage Act from 1917 was not really about spying. The history of it is it was passed as a way of going after leftists who were opposing the war, World War One, and it was a political act from the get-go, and that's how it's being used by the Obama administration, is in its original intent. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And that's what's really dangerous. And the press, which was happy that he didn't get aiding the enemy, because they were afraid if it was aiding the enemy, then these corporate shills in the corporate media could be accused of aiding the enemy too if they report what a whistleblower says. So they're all breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, you know, we can get our sources and, you know, not have to worry about being accused of being aides to spying. But the truth is that even with the Espionage Act, if you just look at somebody like Risen, you know, the reporter for the Times, who's now facing jail because he won't reveal a source for a CIA story he wrote, you know, they can use the Espionage Act as a club even without the aiding the enemy thing.
Exactly. And we all remember, who was it, Judith Miller, for the Times?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with her. Dave, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again real soon, man. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Dave. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dave Lindorf, who is an author, a journalist, a member of the This Can't Be Happening newspaper collective, and we've been talking about the encroaching police state in the U.S. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined again by Sansara Taylor, and we'll be talking about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, so stay tuned.
Murdered the doctor at church on Sunday morning. A shot sent with a warning that women don't deserve a choice. In Wichita, Kansas, which way are we going here? I'm walking through a mob of pro-lifers just to get a pap smear. It's 2009, it's legal to provide. We've come a long way. Though they're standing outside the clinic with bloody signs, old men with drawn faces, plastic fetuses. They murdered the doctor. He'd been shot before in 93. His clinic bombed in 85. For decades he'd been working for the rights of women, the rights of
All right, all right. Welcome back. And that is Kendall Winner. And the song is Dr. Tiller. And joining us now to talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's one of the initiators of the StopPatriarchy.org movement. And Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, you too. Boy, we're getting to talk every week now. This is a pleasure. Okay, there you go. Yeah, well, let's let's jump into this. You're in Wichita, and that song, I just stumbled on that song last night, and it really kind of captures a lot about what is concentrated in this aspect of the whole Freedom Ride, but also this aspect in particular. You're in Wichita now. Before we get into what's happening in the particular thing and what's planned for this stop, let's talk a little bit about why Wichita and what is concentrated there.
Yeah, well, Wichita, Kansas has actually been kind of the heart of a center point or a flashpoint for decades in the fight nationwide over women's right and access to abortion. It is a place most notably right now, I believe, where Dr. George Tiller, a man who for decades served women providing abortions, risked his life every day. He's a man who was stalked, harassed, hounded, terrorized. His children were harassed in school for the fact that he did abortions. And he was assassinated 4 years ago by an anti-abortion fanatic, a Christian fascist gunman. He was stalked and killed in his own church on Sunday when he served as an usher. And he was really somebody who was known and loved by so many people in among abortion providers. He was did later term abortions for women, so women came to him from all over the country, actually all over the world. I know that people who did more complicated abortions in other parts of the country for women who had, you know, health complications for wanted pregnancies, or women who had fetal abnormalities, or women who were very young and didn't have access until very late in their pregnancies to get an abortion, he would, you know, either these women would be flown to his clinic or he would counsel doctors in other places around the country and give them advice and coach them in how to provide services. That he was an incredible resource for the entire abortion providing community, and he was somebody who was really a hero to women. And he was, because of this, he was stalked and hunted. Operation Rescue, one of the most fanatical and Christian fascist anti-abortion organizations that there is, they moved their national headquarters to Wichita about a decade ago, specifically to target Dr. Tiller. And they really did call him public enemy number one. They put a target on his back. They published his home address. They created an atmosphere where this man was killed. And it had reverberations really nationwide and internationally 4 years ago when he was killed. So this is a place, I mean, we could talk, there's a whole history even before that. But this really is a central location in the fight over abortion rights.
You're going into the jaws of the monster is actually really clear when you're describing all this stuff. I consider myself to know quite a bit about what's happened in Wichita and what the Christian fascists are doing and the people who are fighting for abortion rights and whatnot. At the same time, even as you're listening to this, it never ceases to amaze me or just to horrify me when I hear about what's actually been concentrated in a place like Wichita, including, you know, it's very heavy. Like you also stopped at on your way, you stopped in Omaha to Dr. Carhart. And he actually, he's been on the show a number of times, and he's also someone who was very close to Dr. Tiller and actually faces a lot of similar things. I remember I interviewed him once recently, and he said, you know, you have to understand what it's like for us. We go to work every day knowing that when we walk out our front door, from that moment, we could be dead. We may not come home, you know, and yet I still find I have to go out and do this, you know, and this is the kind of thing that I think a lot of people don't get about what's with these doctors and why it's so important around the defense of them.
That's right. I mean, Dr. George Tiller, he actually had survived an assassination attempt earlier. He was shot in both of his arms, and he went back and made sure his clinic stayed open, continued to serve women. And I think the reason Dr. Carhart does this, the reason, you know, a number of doctors around the country who risk their lives and share the same sentiment every single day, they know this could be the day that they are killed. This could be the day that they are taken out, that their clinic is bombed, that their patients are harmed, that their families are harassed or terrorized. And they do it because they understand, and I've talked with Dr. Carhart as well, they understand that without access to abortion, women cannot be free. And if women are not free, then no one is free. And people broadly in society, I don't think, understand this. I mean, there's a big discrepancy between the courage and the conviction of these doctors and other providers and what most people, who if you were to ask them, they'd say, yeah, I'm pro-choice, what most of them are doing right now. No, very few are putting enough on the line and recognizing how central, what's really at stake in this fight over abortion is about the control and enslavement of women, and it's deadly serious. And right now, I mean, we're nationwide, there's a juggernaut of assault, legal restrictions, other restrictions on women's access to abortion, their ability to access it, the shame and stigma that's put on women, and the terror on the doctors. And here, even in Wichita, I think it's very heroic. 4 years after Tiller was killed, there's a new clinic that's been opened here in Wichita. It was a huge battle to get this clinic opened. And it's a great victory, and it's something that people should celebrate and cherish and defend this clinic. But there's a little bit, and I've heard this a number of times, where people have said, well, it's really good. We got the clinic back. So that's good, and it's true. But there's a little bit of thinking that we're kind of back where we were with when Dr. Tiller was serving here. And I don't think that's true. Since those 4 years, yes, there's been a clinic that's been reopened, but there has just been a nationwide, but also here in Wichita, a huge number of restrictions and increased inability to access abortion for women in the state. We were out in one of the malls yesterday and met this young woman, a young black woman who was one of the few people who opened up immediately when we were talking to them about abortion. I mean, everybody opened up to us, but I mean, not everybody, most everybody, but she was the only one who sort of said unabashedly, I just got an abortion. And we were talking, she said she has 4 young children. She couldn't afford another one. She herself was convinced it was wrong to get an abortion, and we said that we disagreed. We talked about that and got into that. But she said, you know, I had to travel all the way to Kansas City to get my abortion because it was later than I can get here in Wichita anymore. So even though the clinic is open, they don't do abortions as late as Dr. Tiller did. There's a number of additional restrictions and lies that the clinics are mandated to tell women about the dangers and risks involved in abortion. And there's an atmosphere very much across the country, but right here in Wichita in particular, we were out, a number of people that we spoke to when we did our broad social investigation were totally unapologetic about the fact that Dr. Tiller was killed. They thought that he got what was coming to him.
Mm.
And that's something that is a public opinion that has been whipped up, that has been created. There's a social base there's a Christian fascist social base that's been built up, and there's a lot of hearts and minds that have been influenced to think that there's something wrong with abortion and that there's something wrong with these doctors who give abortions. And very few people have spoken, and this is a big part of what the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is doing, abortion on demand without apology. Fetuses are not babies. Women are not incubators. Abortion is not murder. And what's really immoral is not abortion, but forced motherhood. That's a form of enslavement. And nobody's said this for so long that when we go out, the most vociferous voices are those who are unapologetic against abortion in all cases. We met so many people who said that to us. And then those who think that this should be a right are very defensive about it. They say, well, yeah, I suppose some women need abortions. I wouldn't take that right away from them. But they don't know that the right is being taken away. But they also are very judgmental of it. The other thing that we found, I just want to share, is that we talked to the teenagers that we talked to, the young women that we talked to, 15, 16 years old, they were saying openly that they felt that, yeah, maybe you should be able to get an abortion when you're young and you're not ready for a baby. But I'm 16 now. I'm ready for a baby. I would keep the baby.
Mm.
And the idea that this is what women's duty is, this is all you're going to do in life, is be a mother at some point, may as well do it sooner or later, and that it's really undesirable to get an abortion is an opinion that has to be fought. We've lost ground. It has to be fought, and that's a big part of what this Freedom Ride is doing.
All right, let me just identify you now, okay? We're talking with Sansara Taylor,
yes.
And she's from Revolution Newspaper, StopPatriarchy.org, and she is on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and they are currently in Wichita, and they're headed to Mississippi, and then back in other places as they head back to New York and the West Coast and over the next couple of weeks. Sansara, you know, as you were talking, I kept thinking about the movie After Tiller. A very powerful film, and one of the things that came out of that film was they make the point that there are only 4 doctors in the country, and I know that the 2 women doctors have been able to start training one other doctor, but there's only 4 doctors right now in the country who perform the kinds of abortions that Dr. Tiller provided to women, and the abortions that are very late in the pregnancy term, but they're extremely needed, and it's extremely important that women have access to this. And 2 of those doctors are actually way up there in age. So you're looking at, when you talk about, for people to understand what this is, not only the threat of assassination, the changing of public opinion, all this other stuff that's going, the molding of reactionary public opinion, but there's actually, this thing is, there's really a clampdown, a shutdown that's going on in this. I mean, how many hospitals even don't teach abortion procedure to doctors these days? This is a major emergency situation we're facing.
Yes, it is. And I think, honestly, it's an indictment, both of the current culture and atmosphere, but also of the system that we live under. I mean, you think about it. What could be more essential to women's role, women's ability to play a full role in society, than the ability to control for themselves when and whether they will have children? And this is a system that has patriarchy, the domination of women by men, woven into its foundation. it's a, like all class divided systems before it, it requires the control over women's reproduction to be able to control inheritance and class divisions from one generation to the next. Who's going to be born into the ruling class? Who's going to be born into the exploited and enslaved classes? This control over women's reproduction and the privatizing of the family is a cornerstone of all oppressive societies, including this capitalist imperialist one. And it would be it's a major part of the revolution we need is the shattering of the oppression of women, the domination of women by men, the control over women's reproduction by a male supremacist society, as well as the shattering of the class divisions that give rise to and require that control. And so this is sort of one thing I think people need to pull back the lens and say, why 40 years after the right to abortion was won, is it more difficult to access, more stigmatized, more dangerous to provide than ever before? Why are we going backwards? And I think fundamentally, because a revolution wasn't made in the 60s, and we need a revolution now. We need it for a number of reasons. But even to get to that revolution and from wherever anybody is coming from, it's time to, you know, take off any blinders, any, you know, sort of blunting of looking at the reality and confront that things are grinding in reverse. There is a war on women, and it's not going away unless it's fought. And there needs to be massive political struggle against this, massive changing in terms, so that this is no longer, people are not allowed to think that this is about babies, that this is about compassion or life or privacy, just your right to have your opinion, my right to have my opinion. This is a fight over whether women will be enslaved or whether women will be free and liberated and able to control their own destinies, but also to contribute to the larger society and be part of struggling to change the larger society. And I think, you know, just what you're describing about the aging out of these doctors, the fact that there are new doctors stepping forward, but some of the new doctors are being the most viciously targeted. The new doctor here in Wichita at this new clinic, she is a very young doctor, a very courageous young woman, and she has been outed by the same people who stalked Dr. Tiller. They dug into the records. They found out who she was. They began stalking her at her home in another city where she flies in from, in Oak Park, Chicago. They've driven her, they've harassed her at her job, she's lost her employment, other places are afraid to hire her because of all the protests that comes with. This is what's going on now, and I think, you know, it requires massive resistance now, and it requires people to really get into and be part of the kind of fundamental change that will change this for good. Mm-hmm. And for all future generations.
Yeah. Now, Sansara, one of the things, we have about 3 minutes left, and I want you to tell people, what are the plans for Wichita? Where to after Wichita? So what are you doing and where are you going?
Okay, so right now as we speak, the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is actually out at the offices of Operation Rescue, who did relocate to Wichita. They're one of the fanatical Christian fascist anti-abortion organizations, and they took over an old clinic that they helped shut down, an abortion clinic, and they turned it into one of those fake clinics, the crisis pregnancy centers that counsels against abortion. So they've gone out with an indictment, crimes against women. They are delivering their indictment today with their crime scene tape and their signs, and they're doing a political action there right now as we speak. And then tomorrow we'll be holding a public abortion on demand without apology rally in a crowded downtown area of Wichita. Then we're going to hit the road. We're going to travel through Little Rock, where there's one clinic left in all of Arkansas. We'll be there. And then we're going to spend about a week down in Jackson, Mississippi, where there's one clinic left in the entire state of Mississippi. And it's only open because of a temporary court injunction. And it's harassed and targeted every single day. And we'll be holding a major rally in support of abortion rights. And people who can should fly into Jackson and be there with us, stand with that clinic. Or drive there if you're in an area that you could drive to there from, or you connect with us at stoppatriarchy.org and get connected in the virtual Freedom Ride and be part of supporting this. And also, I really urge people, wherever you are, to get into this Abortion Rights Freedom Ride and the bigger issues behind it, the kind of revolution we need, at revcom.us, because this is, you know, my last 10 seconds, this is a life and death struggle for the future of women, but it's just one of the fault lines of the crimes of this system. And they come together in the need for massive resistance and all the way fundamental change, revolution, and nothing less.
All right, Sansara, thank you once again. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper, from StopPatriarchy.org, and currently one of the people on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride as it tours through the South. They're currently in Wichita, then heading down to Little Rock, and then Mississippi, where they're going to kick up some stuff, man. And it's everywhere they're kicking up some stuff and really launching this kind of all-out movement to change the terms in society. I want to read something before we go out, because this is something from Bob Avakian that I think is from his book Basics that I think is very apropos for today's whole show. An appeal to those the system has cast off. Here I am speaking not only to prisoners, but to those whose life is lived on the desperate edge, whether or not they find some work. To those without work or even homes. To all those the system and its enforcers treat as so much human waste material. Raise your sights above the degradation and madness, the muck and demoralization, above the individual battle to survive and to be somebody on the terms of the imperialists, of fouler, more monstrous criminals than mythology has ever invented or jails ever held. Become a part of the human saviors of humanity, the grave diggers of this system and the bearers of the future communist society. This is not just talk or an attempt to make poetry here. There are great tasks to be fulfilled, great struggles to be carried out, and yes, great sacrifices to be made to accomplish all this. But there is a world to save and to win. And in that process, those the system has counted as nothing can count for a great deal. They represent a great reserve force that must become an active force for the proletarian revolution. And if you want to know more about Bob Avakian, you can find that out at revcom.us. Again, that's revcom.us. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Carl Dix, Dave Lindorf, and Sansara Taylor. I also want to thank my board op for today, Federico Garcia, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my intern production assistant, Jeff Pryor. And once again, if you want to follow me, you can on Twitter or Facebook. Just again, keep this in mind. Always keep this in mind. Be cool about it because I get real nervous real easy, okay? Anyway, if you want to write to me, you can do that too. And that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that's a very special song. It's a song that's built along the themes of New Boss, Same as the Old Boss. And that is I Can't Take It No More from John Fogerty. And when you're listening, think Bush, Obama, then get mad. Talk to you again next week.
Beating that old dead horse. You know you're not.